Okay, well, welcome everybody. So I will give you a quick overview of my background and interest and problem I'm working on and want to work on in the future. And after that, I will pick one small topic in this big field of non-abelian quantum Hall states, which I want to explain a little bit. And that will be basically the origin of this non-abelian statistics in these quantum Hall states. And I would like to address that point from as simple as terms as possible. So none of all the fancy techniques used to study these fields will be used in this explanation. So I'll try to be as basic as possible. So I already apologize for those people who already know this, because they will probably learn not a lot of new stuff here. But I guess there's a lot of people who are not all that familiar with these non-abelian quantum Hall states, so I hope for them that it will be an interesting thing to hear. So my interests, starting as a PhD student, are basically been working on quantum Hall effect physics. And in particular, these so-called non-abelian quantum Hall states. And hopefully in the end of this little talk, I will have convinced you that this non-abelian nature of these states are closely related to a pairing or clustering of the electrons. And what that means, I will explain you in a little bit. So what kind of techniques are used in this field to study these non-abelian quantum Hall states, or quantum Hall states in general? Well, one of the big things is there's a connection with conformal field theory, which is used, as was introduced by Moore and Reed. So that's a technique used frequently to study these states. And so actually, up to today, basically, there was still a sort of a gap in how to relate conformal field theory to quantum Hall states, in that there wasn't really a good proposal for what conformal field theory to use to describe the Jane states, which are an important part of this theory. But the paper today by Hansen, Jane, and some other people actually made the first step to fill in that gap. So that sort of completes the field. And I won't really discuss that today because it's so new. But one can ask, like, why do we need all this fancy theory to describe these states? So what do we learn from this approach? Well, basically, what we can find out is the possible... Is this actually readable? Or is it really bad? Because it looks sort of unreadable to me, but I'm sorry for that. My handwriting on paper is bad, but on blackboard it's probably even worse. So what do we learn? For instance, we learn what are the possible excitations. There are quantum numbers. And in particular, what is for interest to us, also in the context of this quantum computation business, the statistics. And, well, I'm not going to tell you in a lot of detail how to get from these conformal field theories all these properties, but of course, anybody interested, I'm happy to discuss all of this. And, well, on the side, one of the things I'm really interested in as well is using these physics types arguments to get a connection to the representation situation theory, sorry, of what is called affine D algebras. Because it turns out that there's a very beautiful connection between paired or clustered quantum Hall states and states in the representations of affine Lie algebras. And again, I think this is a beautiful connection, but I won't touch it today. And so let me get on to some other methods which are used to study these quantum Hall states, not really by my work, but by a lot of other people, like Joost has done it, and Jayton and other people, like using to get to these statistics properties. One can also use sort of a shortcut by avoiding this conformal field theory language and make use of so-called quantum groups. And these quantum groups give you a nice algebraic structure of the statistics properties of these quasi-holes. And in Thursday's talk by Joost, he will sort of explain a little bit this connection and how you can use it to get some of the statistics properties. But, well, if we want to actually do some real physics and try to make contact with experiments, and try to see what kind of systems we need to actually get to prove that, for instance, these states have non-abelian statistics, or even go further and try to start thinking of making gates out of these things, then one has to do a lot more work, and these techniques give you an indication of what might be possible. But if you really want to predict what is going to happen, if you put, for instance, two of these quasi-holes with non-abelian statistics close together on a dot and things like that, then I don't think that, well, to get the full sense of what's going on, one would probably need to study the behavior of quasi-holes close together and what the tunneling is and all that. So one would have to get closer to the real experimental situation, probably it will be unavoidable to use numerical calculations to, for instance, what happens if you bring two quasi-holes close together. Is their energy still degenerate, which is what assumed if they're far apart, which is used critically in all these experiments? Well, probably this won't be precisely, doesn't hold precisely anymore when you bring them close together. So to make all the connections with these proposals for topological quantum computation and even the, well, more closely or easily accessible experiments for interferometry and everything, I think also in those things, those experiments, we need to gain a lot of understanding in terms of well, real systems, and that's something I would, it's very interesting, I think. And one of the things I'm working on right now, together with Joost and also Carrion and some other people, is using, for instance, quantum groups and conformal field theory to connect and connect them together to get information about these non-abelian statistics of these states. And that is also those quantum group pictures, what comes out of it, you get your hands on what are called topological quantum field theories, and those are again related to some of the loop models studied by Paul Findlay and Mike Friedman and company, and also Levin and Wang. So there's a nice connection between those topological loop models and these states, and that's also something which would be interesting to investigate a little bit further. So these are sort of the scope of the problems and things I'm interested in and working on. So now I will shift gears a little bit after this introduction and hopefully explain to you why clustered or paired quantum Hall states give rise to non-abelian statistics. And basically these are the arguments I'm going to give you were already given quite some years ago by Chetan Nayak and Frank Wilczek, but I think it might be illuminating for a lot of people to hear about this. So, because I think it's the essence of these, what these non-abelian states are all about. So to do that, I will first remind people of the structure of the Laughlin states. So basically, the Laughlin states describe the state of incompressible fluid of electrons in a magnetic field in two dimensions. And basically, Laughlin gave a variational ansatz wave function for this state, which was shown to be very good in overlap and in energy with the sort of real Hamiltonian with electron interactions. And the form is probably most people here know of this wave function is has this structure, the product, where the z's are the complex coordinates of the electrons in the plane to some odd power, which I will write as m plus 2, so m has to be odd, and why I write it as m plus 2 will become clear. And then there's a exponential damping Ti squared to have the whole thing normalized. And basically, if you would do a variational ansatz for electrons in the magnetic field, anti-symmetric, then basically this is what you get. And to get to the state with quasi-holes presence, basically you can think of quasi-holes being created by piercing a little bit of extra flux, and current flows away from that flux. So there's a little hole in your fluid, and one can describe this hole also in terms of the electron coordinates in this way. So basically, all the electrons are pushed away a little bit from this quasi-hole position, which I label with omega. And also in this talk, Joost on Thursday will probably explain this in a little bit more detail. And if you study this wave function, what you can show is that indeed these the quasi-holes at these locations have a fractional charge and even fractional statistics. So one of the ideas now to go to these non-abelian quantum Hall states is to actually, at first instance, look at a two-layer system. So basically, I will write down a wave function for two layers. So I will label the electrons. So the electrons are now distinguishable in the one and two layers. So I will have electrons in layer one, which I will label by A, and I have electrons in layer two, which I will label by B.
You mean layer? You mean species?
Maybe species is probably a better word.
But break this into symmetry.
Yeah. So species is a better way of saying it. You're right. But if you don't care about that symmetry so much, then you could think of it as layer. But species is a better way of colors or species, whatever you is a better way of thinking about it. And then on top of that, we have an additional overall factor where z can now be either A or B, and we don't care. So it's basically the product here over all electrons. Say, so a two-species wave function would be something like this. At this form. So basically, we have the electrons are distinguishable in this case. And what one can do now is take this wave function and say, like, okay, we want to take a way to get rid of this. The different species, and we want to make them indistinguishable. And one way of doing that is actually basically symmetrizing the first part of the expression over all permutations of electrons of the two species. And if you do that, what you see is that basically the wave function, for the moment, forget about this Laughlin part here. The structure of this wave function is pretty easy to convince yourself that if you take this wave function and you put two now indistinguishable electrons at the same location, this piece of the wave function will be unequal to zero if you do this operation of putting two particles together at the same location. So that's what we call what I will call a Prandtl property. And one thing to notice is people who are familiar with the Pfaffian or the Moore weak state, this for m equals 1 is precisely, you can show it is precisely equal to this Pfaffian quantum Hall state at mu equals 1/2, which in the second Landau level is believed to exist nowadays, which is the prime candidate for non-abelian, a state with non-abelian statistics. So I'm one step away now from why this state would have non-abelian statistics, so I hope I have time to do that. So basically, what we need to do, again, is to introduce quasi-holes again in this system, and say we introduce two small n quasi-holes. So basically what we can naively do is we can just divide the quasi-holes in two different groups and write down factors like ai minus omega j, where now j is 1 to n, and the product, the same thing with the b's.
Excuse me, Andy,
yeah.
Before you get too far into the quasi-holes, I just want to make sure I understand the wave function itself.
Yeah.
The indices are such that every electron z is either an a or a b.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah. So basically, the a and the j go from 1 to n, and the l and the k go from, say, n plus 1 to 2n.
And what about the i?
And the i and the j's here would go all from 1, so I smaller j, where 1 smaller or equal, and all the way up to 2n, so basically all electrons. So the z's can either be an a or a b in this case. This is an overall...
So why did you say that the wave function doesn't...
So if you forget about this part here, yeah,
yeah, can't,
no, but if you symmetrize over all permutations of these coordinates, which are now just erased, to go, then there's always one term in the symmetrization which will give a non-vanishing result. Well, there are probably many terms, yeah, but there's at least one, yeah, so.
And what gives you the factor of 2 that you said was important in the first line, m plus 2?
Oh, okay. Well, basically, if you don't do this clustering property here, so there's squares here, which basically were this 2 here. So this will give you a whole series of states. And the Reed Vasari states, if you don't do this 2 species, but in general, say, k species, then you will get what is called the clustered states with clustering K property, which are the Reed-Vasari states labeled by K and M. So this is just a convenient way of splitting off this factor M here.
And how the Hilliard fraction is related to M?
So in this case, of course, you basically have mu is 1 over M plus 2, so you need M odd. And in this case, in general, if you have K species, the Hilliard fraction would be K over Km plus 2. And so for k equals 2, you get precisely 1 over m plus 1, which is precisely the filling fraction for the Pfaffian wave function for m odd.
How do I see that obviously y
so if you take m equals 1 here, it's not obvious, but you can show by looking at the structure of the zeros here, you can convince yourself that also including this one here, this m equals 1 state, you can convince yourself that is in fact equal to the Pfaffian state. And I can explain you this later if you want.
Is the filling each of the species or in overall?
This is the overall filling after you do the symmetrization. In fact, it doesn't matter. But it's all the species added together.
The state doesn't have a plateau.
No. So the plateau would be if you look at this state in the second Landau level, so you have a whole filled Landau level of inert electrons, then the state on top of that filled Landau level is presumably, based on numerical evidence, is described by this clustered
well,
state.
He's written a wave function. He hasn't mentioned the Hamiltonian.
No,
It looks like it's not at mu equals a half.
No, at mu equals a half. So basically, the details of the interactions in the different Landau levels give rise to very different physics. So in the lowest Landau level, you have all these odd denominator fractions, Jane states and everything. In this first excited Landau level, you have probably something which is related to this Pfaffian state. And in even higher Landau levels, you have these charged density wave ordered states. So it seems that going up in lambda level really changes the type of physics which these samples show. So the details of the interactions in this system are very important. And there's a hope that something like this might happen in the second lambda level.
But precise answer to the question is that this wave function does have a plateau.
At 5.
It's equal to half, but it may not be the ground state of any Hamiltonian in any physical system.
Yeah.
So the question of whether the real system has a plateau or not is a totally different question.
Yeah.
The wave function doesn't answer.
Oh, no, sure. The wave function doesn't really know. All these considerations.
Wave function is a wave function. So, whether it has a plateau.
Yeah. And the conformal field theory methods won't be able to address that question at all. So.
I think that the bypass state is a pairing of 1/2. Right? That's how you open the gap.
Yeah.
I mean, the response to that is it doesn't have to be pairing. Yeah. I mean, this is not a question you can answer just by thinking.
No.
This is something you really read the Hamiltonian. Not all questions can be answered by thinking.
You can answer by
pairing. You have a calculation for
it. Yeah.
Actually, what extent is it known from experiments that this U equals half state, the HLO state, doesn't actually become a plateau state if you keep cool?
Nobody knows.
Known to 2 millikelvin.
Yeah.
Known to 2 to 5 millikelvin, which is the lowest temperature you can cool this thing to.
And also, it probably might depend on mobility, and that's also not known.
The numerical experiments are pretty definitive that in the lowest lambda level, which is the point that was being made, at least for any Hamiltonian, that this, these three systems will have, you don't expect plateau strictly musical.
But of course, yeah, the experiments will always give you the ultimate answer, I guess. So we have our two species wave function now. And we see that if we just look at now the wave function where we do not symmetrize, then basically these two species are distinguishable from each other. So if we would start braiding these quasi-holes around each other, basically what we do is we change the ordering of the species in this wave function. And that does give us abelian statistics, but nothing non-abelian. The non-abelian statistics comes in when we again start doing this symmetrization procedure where we symmetrize over all different A and B different species of electrons. In that case, what happens is that the 2n factorial over 2 to the n factorial squared ways of distributing these 2n quasi-holes over A and B species, not all those states, as was beautifully explained by Nayak and Wilczek, they are not all the independent anymore. There's only 2 to the n minus 1 independent ways of independent wave functions in this whole set of wave functions. So the number of linearly independent states I've written down is greatly reduced by doing this symmetrization and obtaining indistinguishable electrons and indistinguishable quasi-holes. And now if we start, so now basically we have arrived at a situation where we have a quantum hole system, and if we put indistinguishable quasi-holes in our system, then basically there's more than one possible realization of this. Basically, there's, in this case, 2 to the n minus 1 realizations of this state with indistinguishable quasi-holes. And now if you start braiding these quasi-holes around each other, then it can be shown by conformal field theory quantum group methods that, in fact, we do not just pick up abelian phases when we start braiding quasi-holes around each other, but we do pick up phase matrices which actually bring you from one of these 2 to the n minus 1 states to a linear combination of them by braiding. And these, it can be shown that these matrices indeed do not commute. And so in the end, that this will give, this gives rise to non-abelian statistics in these quantum Hall systems. And the point I would like to stress is that it's basically this pairing property we had in the ground state wave function. Every time something like that happens, arguments like this can go always through. So I would say that this pairing or clustering structure in general is ultimately what gives rise to these non-abelian statistics inside the regime of the fractional quantum Hall effect, which is what we have used as assumptions always, that we're in fractional quantum Hall effect situation.
You don't necessarily have to equally partition your quasi holes in the two layers of the
No,
states,
right? No.
We generate new states by putting, let's say, more, or all of them, for example, in one layer. Get one of the 2n-1 states.
I think they would give you different different type of excited states of these. I guess in the end they would give rise to different states.
Doing the same for the two layers.
Sorry.
In the wave function you wrote down, doing the same for the two layers, right?
Well, yeah. But you don't have, well, the question is if you don't partition them evenly, do you get a different state or not in general? And I think in general the state might be different. Sorry?
No, he's just talking about, you're just talking about partitioning the quasi
world. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
then you get rise to different.
Yeah. So I think if you don't partition them equally,
yeah,
create a different excitation.
For instance,
I'm not sure after symmetrization.
No, after symmetrization, that's something which is not obviously so. But for instance, if you would look at spin singlet generalizations of these states, which I've been interested in myself, then distributing these particles differently will actually give rise to different excited states. But in this case, it's not obvious whether you get the same or not. I would have to think about that. So basically, in the end of the day, the message is paired or clustered states in quantum Hall effect will give rise to non-abelian statistics, hopefully, in experiments. But that remains to be seen. Thank you.
So can you say a couple of sentences about what is the spin singlet that you alluded to answering Kuhn's question? But you said you're interested in spin singlet.
Well, there. What is? What I've been starting in my PhD research, what I've been interested in is these are all spin polarized states. But it turns out that there's a natural way of generalizing these states to spin singlet states, and there you can ask the same question: are there spin singlet states which show non-abelian statistics? And if so, what are the properties? And it turns out that, for instance, states, these spin polarized states, the first candidate, which are universal for quantum computation, are, for instance, related to a state which has a not a pairing, but a clustering of three particles. In these spin singlet states, the first state which would be suitable if found for universal quantum computation is actually a paired state. So by including this extra spin, you can go down from a clustering to a pairing and not lose the properties that they might be, if found, are universal for quantum computation. So in that sense, I think those are very interesting proposals to investigate. And there's extra spin structure, so you might be able to get a better handle on braiding and have more intricate structure, which you might be able to use to efficiently do unitary rotations in the systems. And again, you only need pairing. Of course, you need spin singlet states to start with, and there's no real evidence in the in experiments that there are these non-abelian spin singlet states are there. But of course, one never knows if they find them. We can write down a wave function.
The fractional filling. I mean,
the fractional filling in general is.
Yeah.
2k over 2km plus 3, so for k equals 2 and m is 1, the lowest physical value you get 4/7. And there are states seen at 4/7, and depending on pressure, there's transitions observed. But of course, whether this has anything to do with these non-abelian spin singlet states, that's something we have no clue about.
Has anybody looked at Opal lab numerically?
No.
If you can write in a wave function, one can in principle calculate.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, maybe partial answer to your question is you know, if you put different numbers of quadrilles in the two layers, mm-hmm. you can think of that as putting the same number in both layers, and then whichever layer has you want to have fewer, just take those quadrilles to infinity. Mm. So it probably just differs by an edge excitation from the case you're interested in, you know, from the case of equal numbers.
But these states can be written down on the sphere or on a torus as well, right? In principle.
Yeah, probably you have to have your numbers to put it on the torus. And when you symmetrize to put it on the torus, you probably do have to have equal numbers.
So then you don't have that option.
Yeah, but that's
I see.
On a disk, that might not be.
Yeah.
So, for instance, one of the properties of these spin singlet states, if you sort of introduce a polarization by hand and make everything polarize the same way, you actually get back to this polarized state. So there's if you would do the thing you would ask, but now in spin language, then if you make everything spin polarized, you go back to this state. So there, in this, that state, it does make a difference what you do.
So can't you do the same pairing to, let's say, a Hilbert state, which is a spin singlet? Is that possible?
Pairing to a Hilbert state precisely gives you these spin singlet states. So this can be seen as having a pairing over a spin singlet Hilbert state with labels m minus 1. So if we put k equals to 1 without pairing, that's precisely what we get.
Any other questions? No? Thanks, speaker. Quick announcement though. Thursday is pedagogical lecture. Yos, can you give it at 2:30 instead of 2?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So, unlike last week, the pedagogical lecture is going to start at 2:30. It will go till 3:15 when there's tea. Those of you who are interested can go to tea and then come back and listen to the second half of it, and those of you who aren't can drift off into the sunset, okay? Or whatever. Let's see, is there another announcement you want to make? Oh yeah, but next week, quick show of hands. How many people are actually going to be here, and how many will be at the March meeting?
Maybe one or the other, though.
Well, I think I know the song. Right? So, how many people are going to be here next week? Oh, okay. Large number. Okay.
A lot of mathematicians in this club.
Okay.
There you go.
Work. Well, let's see. I hope you hear me. Okay. So I will talk about my recent work on fault-tolerant quantum computation. It's in the one-way quantum computer model, and for those of you who don't know it, I will explain it very briefly. Maybe I should have said that. I'm Robert Rausendorf, and I arrived yesterday. Anyway, so just to give you, maybe many of you will start from a different perspective for looking at things, so let me say where I start from. So I'm interested in fault-tolerant quantum computation. And a very important result is the threshold theorem in fault-tolerant quantum computation. And it was established in the late 90s. Many people, Kitaev, Dorit Aharonov, Steen contributed. Anyway, what does it say? It says that when I need to compute with noisy operations, provided that the noise level of my elementary operations is below a certain level, then with a small overhead, I can perform arbitrarily accurate and arbitrarily large quantum computations. So that is a very important result. And now you may ask, why care? Because I think you're planning to do it with two-dimensional electron gases, and suppose you can realize filling factor 12/5, then you may expect that you can do all your universal operations fault tolerantly. So it appears to me that from this perspective, the question of having a threshold doesn't address itself. But then there are sort of little bit hybrid schemes, like, for instance, Sergey schemes. So suppose you can't yet realize filling factor 12 over 5, and you try it with 5 over 2. And then you again have, as far as I understand, non-abelian anions, but they are not universal. So you need to think of extra constructions that provide you with universality and which are also fault-tolerant. And one thing that you can do is magic state distillation. So you start with a large number of certain quantum states, noisy quantum states, and using distillation protocols that you can do with your topological gates, you purify these states, and in this way you make the scheme universal and fault tolerant. So in this setting, the question of a threshold sneaks back in, because your initial non-topological states that you need as a resource need to be sufficiently pure, sufficiently close to what you want them to be. Okay, so I think the threshold question should also be for your interest, or should be interesting for you. So in the first round of investigations, the threshold theorem was established. So it is very important to have the theorem as such, and it was not important what the threshold, what the numerical value of the threshold actually was. But now more detailed investigations are being made, and now we really care. So what is the threshold? Where are we experimentally? Is there a gap? Are we already there? And we are not. And theorists try to improve the threshold value, and they also look at the overhead. You want to reach the threshold value at a small overhead. And, well, this is the area to which I'm contributing. So I will talk about a construction. It's a fault-tolerant one-way quantum computer that gives you a good threshold value at a moderate overhead. And this is what I'm discussing today. And the reason I am discussing it here in this audience is that it has a link with topology through Alexei's surface codes. Okay. So I hope I have set the stage for what I'm going to say. And I'm going to talk about the fault-tolerant one-way quantum computer. First, let me tell you what the one-way quantum computer is. So, the one-way quantum computer uses a resource state, the so-called cluster state. And what is the cluster state? Consider a two-dimensional lattice of qubits, so each dot that I've shown here represents a qubit, and this lattice of qubits is prepared in a particular way, and this preparation, independent of the size of the state on this two-dimensional lattice, is created in two steps. First step, every qubit is prepared in the eigenvalue plus eigenstate of the Pauli operator sigma x. I call this state plus. Second step, switch on the easing interaction for a finite time interval, and this time interval is independent of the size of the state. Switch the easing interaction off, and that creates the cluster state. So the operational effort that it takes to create the state, the temporal complexity to create the state, is independent of the size. That is the cluster state. And, that's a way to create it. Let me briefly tell what the cluster state is also. Well, the cluster state is the unique eigenstate of the following stabilizer operators, Ka. So A is a site in the lattice, and this is A, and the corresponding stabilizer operator Ka is Pauli operator sigma x here, and Pauli operator sigma z on all of its neighbors, well, the tensor product of this. Okay.
Sorry, what do the word stabilizer mean?
Pardon?
The word stabilizer, what does it mean?
Yeah. It is, well, okay, so you have a bunch of eigenvalue equations like this. So the cluster state is an eigenfunction of all these operators with eigenvalue 1. And, this is a way to define the state. And in order to uniquely define the state, you need a number of such operators, and these operators form a group, and this group is called the stabilizer group. And the Ka that I have explained what they are, they generate this group. Okay?
Some of our advantages specify a state by specifying the operators for which this
it is an eigenstate. Okay. Okay, if that is sort of unfamiliar to you, Let me briefly explain why we do this. Well, it's just a matter of efficiency. So this is a very efficient way to describe the state. Well, what you also could do is just write it down in some local basis, but that would give you an awful lot of terms. So whatever local basis you choose, the number of terms would scale exponentially with the number of sites you have here. And this is pretty uneconomical, so we need large states, and just writing it down in some basis, it's just too cumbersome.
In the spirit of the last lecture, I think you could give the wave function also, right?
The wave function?
Yeah, explicitly. Isn't the wave function equal superposition of all classical spin states with coefficients either plus or minus 1 depending on some simple parity issue?
Yeah, you might write it like that.
I think the parity actually is if you take any subset of your lattice, you look at the parity of the number of bonds contained within the subset. That determines the sign.
Oh, let me see. What would you do?
So in other words, if you want the sign in front of, if you have subset S on which the spins are up and the complement of S on their down, then I think it's just the sign is determined by the number of bonds in your lattice taking up to up spins.
Okay, so I could... Well, I never wrote it down, for a very long time I haven't written it down in an explicit basis. But let me tell you what you can do, and I think it's roughly what you said. Maybe it's exactly that. So what a good idea would be is to choose a checkboard pattern for the local basis. You choose the eigenbasis of sigma z on all these sides, say all the black sides, and you choose the eigenbasis of sigma x. At this site, and what would it be? So you would have a 0x, 1x, depending on the parity of zeros and ones on the neighboring sites. Depending on the number of the parity of the ones on the neighboring sites, something like that. Presumably, there are many equivalent descriptions of that. So much about that. So that's the formulation we use. I won't make use of it very often today. So if you find it sort of inconvenient, doesn't matter too much for the purpose of my talk. So I have so far only explained what a cluster state is, but let me explain what one-way quantum computation is. And I'm just saying, what you do, to perform universal quantum computation, all you need to do is to measure these qubits independently in some local basis. So that's all you need to do. What you need to do the computation is you need an easing interaction, and it's just uniform interaction and local measurements, and that constitutes the computation. So a quantum circuit is encoded in the measurement basis of these local observables, and of course the measurement outcomes are random, right? But that doesn't affect the computation. It is the information processing is nevertheless deterministic. The only effect of the randomness of the measurement outcomes is that the measurement outcomes at certain sites affect the measurement basis at other sites. So we have a temporal order among the measurements, and measurement bases need to be adapted, but that's it. That gives you deterministic quantum computation.
Sorry, what is the basis you're measuring at the various sites?
All right, I mean, I could tell you what the choices are. So we're not using the entire Bloch sphere. So what we are using of the Bloch sphere, say this is the x eigendirection, y, z, we use c measurements, and we're using the equator of the Bloch sphere. And once I've drawn the picture, I can also show you what the effect of adaption of measurement basis is. Well, you have an angle alpha here with the x-axis, and the only thing that can happen due to all the measurement outcomes is that the angle alpha is flipped into minus alpha. Okay. All right, so that's one-way quantum computation, but what I want to talk about today is fault-tolerant one-way quantum computation. So, and the way you make it fault-tolerant is you go from a 2D cluster state to a 3D cluster state. And well, there are many ways to do it, but this is the way I want to talk about. And in a three-dimensional cluster state, you get the fault tolerance free by the lattice structure, and this is related to the surface code. And, well, this is intended to be the topic of my introduction here. So let me draw this cube again. And this is now a macroscopic picture. We have a three-dimensional lattice here, and it's really large. So the qubits, well, they are very small and sit very close to another in this picture. And this three-dimensional cluster is just a set of qubits, and this set of qubits is subdivided into three subsets. And I would like to give you now a characterization of these three subsets. And what distinguishes them and so forth, what they are good for. So most of this is the cluster region V. Cluster region V is almost everywhere. And it is characterized by the qubits in this cluster region being measured in the x eigenbasis. X basis. Okay. And then there is other stuff in here, and do I have a second color? Let's see. No. Okay. I need to think about something. Okay, then there's other stuff in here. There are donuts. So I've just drawn a loop, but these loops have a certain thickness. And they come in two kinds. So I'm drawing one out of two lines, which just should indicate that this object is something different from this object here. Okay, and then we have such a guy. And sometimes they are not exactly loops. Okay, and these are called defects. And it's a primal defect. And this is a dual defect. Okay. That makes the cluster region D. And the qubits in D are measured in the eigenbasis of sigma z. That's what characterizes this set of qubits. Well, not all of these guys, not all of these defects are exactly loops. Sometimes they hold in place a particular qubit of a different kind. So that's just one qubit, and that we call cluster region S. And it again is subdivided into primal dual, but I'm not going into that right now. And well, measured in, these qubits are individually measured in the eigenbasis of x plus minus y. Okay, so I have given you what's there, and I've given you the characterization of these three sets. And now I would briefly like to explain what these sets are for. Well, the set V is four-fold tolerance, and it's in fact topological four tolerance related to the surface code, the defects D are for logic, or I should say, well, they are for logic, but only the so-called Clifford part of logic, so that contains gates like the CNOT gate and the Hadamard gate and so forth. And these qubits here are required for logic, but the non-Clifford part. And, well, the Clifford part alone is not universal, so we need these qubits in here. Okay. All right. At this point, let me tell you what the result of all these investigations is. First, what I write about here is can be checked out. Quant pH 0.5, 10, 1, 3, 5. Okay, and the result is this. We come up, so if we have an error model with the following sources, we have preparation errors for our individual qubits, errors for the easing interaction to create the cluster state, and we have storage errors and measurement errors. If all these error sources contribute equally, then we get a threshold value of 0.1%. Okay, so that's the result of these investigations. And I should remind you that this is for a setting with local and next neighbor operations only, so it's a pretty good threshold value. And I think I can improve it to 0.6%. So that is the result. And okay, so in the remaining 0 minutes, I'd like to talk a little bit about the fault tolerance that I have in this scheme and about the way I implement logic. And I will be talking about the way I implement logic because this also leads me to address questions that maybe I can answer with your help in this workshop. Okay. I just want to discuss fault tolerance very briefly here, and I don't have the time to give a complete argument, but I would like to point out what it has to do with the surface codes. So here, consider the surface code on just a part of the plane. So we have some lattice here, qubits sitting in the middle of the edges, so on and so forth. So just to remind you, I guess it's not really necessary anyway. So the surface code has stabilizer generators associated with each plaquette of the lattice, which is a four-fold tensor product of sigma z, and then you have additional ones, four times sigma x, associated with each site. Okay, so what's the connection with cluster states? So it will be a connection with a 2D cluster state. Namely, take a cluster state now, different type of lattice, qubits sitting on the sides. And measure you measure the, now half of the qubits in the following basis as indicated here. Okay, so the state that you end up with for the unmeasured qubits is a state in the code space of the planar code. So this is the connection. And now, well, it's just a state in the code space, you might not care very much. But now I would like to take this connection one dimension higher up, and I go from a 2D setting to... Was there a question? Okay. So now I go from a 2D setting to a 3D setting. Okay. So this is a three-dimensional cluster. Now I do a similar measurement pattern. So I see that two of the dimensions in my cluster are taken up by the code word or by a code word. And now I have a third dimension. And what do I do with it? I can simulate a time axis with it. So what I could do, it's not particularly interesting, but nevertheless, what I could do is $4 on data storage with a toric code, or with a surface code. I could simulate it in such a 3D block of cluster state. Okay, and $4 on data storage with a toric code has been analyzed numerically, and it has been found that error correction procedure here maps to a model in statistical mechanics, classical statistical RPMG, statistical mechanics, and it has been analyzed by Preskill, Landau, Dennis, and Kitaev. And, well, this is well understood, and it gives you a 3% error threshold for a local error model, which by itself is not very realistic. And the same error correction, because we can map it to the cluster model in three dimensions, the same error threshold you get here in this model, but now this error of 3% is distributed among a number of sources, and that brings down the overall threshold. Okay, that much I wanted to say.
What does RPMG mean?
Random Plaquette gauge model. So maybe I have permuted things a little bit. Yeah. Maybe it's like this. It's called Random Plaquette Z2 gauge model in three dimensions. I guess it's more or less a full name. Yeah. Okay. So that much about the error correction. Now, this planar code that I've been drawing here is not exactly what I will be using. Now I'm starting to talk about logic, and maybe just briefly, and then I leave it at that. So what I will be using is not a plane with particular boundary conditions, rough edges here and smooth edges here, but I will use plane with two holes. And, well, the exact type of the exterior boundary doesn't really matter. So we have the encoded Z operator, say, as an operator that tensor product of sigma Z's encircling that hole, and the encoded X just stretches from one hole to another. So this will be the elementary Pauli operators in our encoded qubit. So now we take that picture one dimension higher up, right? And these holes now become extended into the third dimension. Okay. And, well, the holes extend to the third dimensions are just the defects. So the logic in this scheme is encoded in the way these defects are wound around another. And I give you a couple of examples, or just a few. So what we've seen here is the identity gate. And so, okay, I need two holes for a qubit. And I show you a C-naught. Okay, so this is the other kind of defect. I mentioned that you have two. I don't know exactly what the control and what the target is. Maybe the other way around. Anyway, that is a C-naught. And you could establish a number of other gates in just by winding defects around another. That's the basic technique. And just by sort of bringing two defects together. But it is not, well, this is all just Clifford stuff. You won't get out of the Clifford group with these operations, so you need something extra in my constructions. And this is pretty much related to what Sergei has done, but I'm not going to talk about it right now. If you're interested, just talk to me. It would be very interested too. But I would like to outline what I would like to discuss in the future, and maybe this is a good figure to to discuss this. Okay, so the first thing is to do what I promised, to bring the threshold up. But I think I can do it alone. I don't need to talk to anybody. But what I am interested in, I mean, and this is what I come here for. So what I'm really interested in is getting, and at this, I think the more interesting question than a threshold, is to better reveal the mathematical structure that I have in the model. So it has to do with homology, and well, I didn't have the time here to explain what it has to do with homology, but that is pretty clear. But then a more sort of speculative question is, well, these defects here, can I regard them as world lines of particles which are being braided and fused? Well, we see these defects winding around another, so that's a meaningful question that I could address. Are these world lines of particles that are braided and fused and created? Yeah, and for that to occur, well, the particles had to obey certain properties, and yeah, well, that's something I would be interested in discussing with you while I'm here.
Thank you.
I didn't understand what the qubit was in that diagram. So you had a disk with two punctures to the qubit?
Well, that's the support of the qubit. So I need...
You have unique fusion channels in the Tor code, so how do you store information in a puncture disk?
Well... where was it? Did I erase it? Well, if I have a plane with two holes, it's a 2D diagram. What I have shown you is what the encoded Pauli operator sigma z and sigma x look like. So I say my encoded qubits lives in a, well, in this Tori code language, it lives in a plane with two holes.
But if the three
boundary labels are specified, that has a one-dimensional Hilbert space,
a disk with two
holes. No? I'm not sure, Alexei. that would. I mean, if that was true, then my explanation wasn't right. So, how, if I have a plane with two holes, can I store a qubit in this arrangement?
I think in the Tori code, if you know the charges of those holes, you cannot store information.
Okay, so what I'm... well...
You can, of course, store information on a closed surface with the Tor code using the four-dimensionality of the Hilbert space of torus.
Okay.
But for planar surfaces, if the boundary charges are known, you have a one-dimensional space.
Okay.
This is why people usually look at EQFTs that have multiple fusion channels.
Okay. One thing here. So, this is something that needs to be sorted out. So I have presented the scheme here in a little bit in a different way than what I have used here in this reference. So this reference does not make use of gates. So it looks now that my result is in question and that needs to be resolved here. And my result is based on a different method, and I'm not talking about using codes and stuff. But, I mean, this is something that needs to be resolved, and I'm astonished about it. And I would like this to be clarified.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions?
Yes, a question?
You said it was related to this RPGM for Z2.
Yes.
What are the two loops, the different types of loops in the Z2 model? How do you characterize them? The different
character of these two defects in itself.
Okay. So what gives me these two defects here? Okay, there's something that I didn't mention about my lattice. So what I'm using is a body-centered cubic lattice. So where the qubits live is on the edges of, so this is an elementary cell of the lattice, and the qubits live on the edges and on the faces of this lattice. So now there is a corresponding dual lattice to that. Namely, if I translate the whole lattice by this vector, 1, so this is distance of 2, if I translate this lattice by this vector, I end up in the same state, but my lattice is not mapped onto itself. So I map the lattice to the respective dual lattice, and this, because I have these two lattices here, I have all these objects as primal and dual. And now, what distinguishes them? So, I have part of my cluster measured in, so suppose this is down here, is V region, and this is the defect region. So, and I have my elementary, this is just a 2D picture. Oh, it's probably too small for you to see. Anyway,
probably asking for an answer within the confines of the Z2 gauge theory, where probably he was asking whether there are charges and fluxes or something like that, right?
Yes.
Within the gauge theory, what do the two defects correspond to?
Okay, I haven't worked it out. I don't know that yet.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, yeah, sure.
First of all, I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me to come to this great, great scientific program. I'm interested in topological quantum computation, and I came basically from quantum computation community. And I, you know, appreciate the opportunity to learn more about the condensed matter aspects of topological phases, which I think are regarded today as essential materials for topological quantum computation. There are two ways how to get these materials. Well, the first one is to find them somewhere, like we hope to find them in fractional quantum Hall states, sort of presumably the fitting 5 over 2 and 12 over 5. But an alternative to that might be to design these topological phases, to design systems that would carry the topological phases using some suitable physical platforms. These can be neutral atoms in optical lattices or trapped ions. These two kinds of systems would have an apparent advantage of being highly controllable, having low decoherence, etc. Other options exist as well. We can use Josephson junctions, for instance. There has been a proposal by IOFI to implement topological phases, or more accurately, topological quantum computation in Josephson junction. I more understand the atomic physics system, so I would like to, maybe as an ultimate goal, I would like to see the realization of topological phases in these kind of systems. I believe that would eventually lead to some sort of a new materials which we could, you know, make at wish, you know, design them for some specific purposes. That goal is definitely very far away, but there might be a way to it. And the way to get to this designer topological phase has in some extent been outlined recently by Alexei Kitaev and by Michael Friedman, Chetanayak, and Kirill Stengel in the works about microscopic models that can actually implement perhaps topological phase as the microscopic material. So I got a great inspiration in the papers about the extended Hubbard model for what I'm going to talk about, what I was interested in. Recently, in the last few years, partly at Berkeley and partly at my new appointment at the National University of Ireland at Maynooth, in a small town close to Dublin in Ireland. And what I'm interested in is the properties of the extended Hubbard model. Effectively, what Michael Friedman, Chatanayak, and Kirill Shtengel did was that they proposed a very nice procedure how to, sort of a recipe, how to get topological phases in quantum loop gases. So having quantum loop gas, we have this two-dimensional sea of fluctuating loops, or more precisely multi-loops, perhaps some long loops as well. I can call this set of all possible multi-loops S.
This is loop of what?
Pardon?
This is loop of what object? This is loop of what? You said in a two-dimensional system, loops.
Two loops in 2D systems.
Loops of what object?
I will get to that if you
allow me. So this is just abstract loops now?
So far it's abstract, okay? So these are loops in two-dimensional systems, and you can construct a set of complex value functions which over the set of loops and basically are trying to get to the point where we have some Hilbert space which describes the low energy properties describe the topological phase. So in this particular recipe, which was put down by the authors I mentioned, the first step is really to induce the isotopy. So if we have the wave function for this set of multi-loops, and the multi-loops differ by just smooth deformations, then both wave functions are identical. The second step, the result of this first step, is actually set of complex valued function over the complexity classes. Set of complex valued functions over the set of loops up to the small deformations. So it would be. The other step in this procedure would be to induce d-isotopy, which says that two wave functions are identical. Up to a small loop and small renormalization coefficient, which is actually a real number. And in that case, we would get a system which is already critical. That's really it's a critical point between bubble and geodesic phase of this quantum loop gas. And it's described by a very highly degenerate ground state, so it's very unstable. And would have tendency to spontaneously collapse into a topological phase, presumably. So it would be described by the Hilbert space of some finite dimension, which depends actually on the topology of the system. So this idea, and the last step I should say, is actually carried out by imposing certain conditions for surgery or cutting and reconnecting these loops of quantum loop gas. And these are called Jones-Mensel projectors. So keeping this recipe in mind, this has been in some extent realized in the extended Hubbard model. So what the extended Hubbard model is, first of all, it is a model whose filling is 1/6, and it's a model on Kagome lattice, it's an extended Hubbard model. Talk about this. Looks like this. Okay. And its Hamiltonian consists of the following terms. The first one is just ensuring that the model is singly occupied. That means there are never two particles at a single side, or this U naught is infinity. What follows are three potential energy terms. This one is a chemical potential term, which kind of modulates the energy, potential energy landscape. The other step, or other term, is a repulsion for two particles at the same hexagon. Another term is a repulsion for two particles at the same bow tie, but not at the same hexagon. Effectively, that means the particles are at the opposite sides of the bow tie. And the last term is a tunneling term between nearest neighbors. Which may look like this. Now, this model, with this occupation, this condition, is a very nice representation. The dual picture, in the dual representation, is a loop representation on a triangular lattice. Some of these sides are colored. These sides would be red. They eventually translate into the dual lattice as a background dimer covering, one of the perfect matchings. And then the occupied sides create the other dimer covering, which eventually creates this loop configuration. Now the model itself is effectively, as it was, as far as I understood the paper of Michael Fishman, Chetanayak, and Kirush Sengel, basically the model implements the d-isotopy, and assuming that the system is unstable, assumes it collapses into topological phase, right? So,
just a question about the model. So this is for spinless fermions.
This is occupation model, completely occupation. There's 1/6 particles in the lattice, so you can have atoms per different sides, for instance. Actually, it does not matter at all, because they are singly occupied anyway.
There's a regime, and the solution to the equation is slightly different, whether they're spinless fermions or bosons, but there's solutions to both regimes.
Yeah, what the authors proposed are four different models. Two of them are bosonic and two of them are fermionic. But what I was focusing on was first of the bosonic models, which is the simplest one available. So,
for the bosonic model, it's actually a spin model, right?
You could call it a spin model. You could rewrite, you could think of it as occupation, and you could rewrite the mathematical terms in terms of pollinators. You could call it a spin model.
Excuse me, but the fermionic model and the bosonic model are different, even they do not sit on the same side.
Yeah, okay, the solution exists for both bosonic and fermionic models. Mm-hmm. What I used for calculations was just the bosonic model, because it's simpler.
Okay.
And simpler in the sense that it does not need, actually the interactions of this model are depend on the side which is occupied. So you can see the lattice is actually colored, and the color determines what kind of interaction in that particular location of the lattice. It's in some sense a very complicated model. Okay, so it's it's a sort of an advantage to start with that model, which is simple, out of these possible complicated models. So that means effectively to minimize the number of colorings and minimize the number of different terms in the Hamiltonian. Okay.
The model
is, I think, solvable up to the diisotopy point.
Does it mean
that
you
mean
the ground state
exactly? So what I was interested in was calculating the spectrum numerically and calculating the low energy spectrum of these systems. Systems that would be, you know, the basically fragment of the cagomalities with the appropriate interactions. And for that purpose,
and this model is soluble for any U0, U, mu, V, or you have to fine-tune the statement is what, soluble for in whole parameter space?
So each of these steps imposes certain conditions on quantum loop gas, right? So each of these terms is effectively a restriction or constraint on the parameters, okay? The isotopy and isotopy are restrictions on the parameters. Actually, the isotopy is more important in this case. So I'm sure someone will talk about this model in detail, you know, in the near future. I just want to say what I found really interesting about it is that, you know, it assumes that it is a model which is solved up to the diisotopy point. That means up to this, up to this moment. And it's nice to think about it, but once it would be realized physically in some laboratory, presumably it would collapse into topological phase, because the physical perturbations of the system, the very unstable system, would actually bring it to the topological phase, would implement this Jones-Wenzel projectors, which are the rules to cut and reconnect the loops, quantum loop gas. But I was kind of curious, because at this point, you know, is it true that it will collapse if you do it in the lab? Or can we just do some sort of a different type of experiment? Can we take the system and start looking at the spectrum maybe numerically? Try to identify whether we can find that critical region where the system is diisotopic with this Hamiltonian plus set of constraints which come from the diisotopy. Constraints effectively fixing the values of the numerical values of the parameters or certain conditions on parameters. And can we figure out some additional term in the Hamiltonian, like some perturbation that would actually by itself implement the Jones-Wenzel projectors? So can we actually make this final step? And I don't have the definitive answer to that yet, but this is what I'm very much interested in. Finding the physical form of the, you know, of this condition, finding the physical embodiment in terms of some Hamiltonian term, which we could add to some critical model to bring it towards topological phase. In order to calculate these things, I developed kind of a different approach than people typically use. So I was interested in calculating the ground state and low-lying spectral properties, the low-lying states. And I was used to propagate quantum dynamics in real time effectively. So I decided that it might be an interesting strategy actually to calculate the ground state. This would be the ground state of some many-body system. It can be the extended Hubbard model, but in fact it can be any model of similar sort. And calculate it using a relaxation method, meaning that we calculate the ground state as a from some trial initial state by just propagating this state in imaginary time. that would by itself be surprising at all. We can reformulate this as a just a very simple thing using some transfer matrix, or properly renormalized, I guess. Apply transfer matrix over psi. We will have p psi. Okay. Just okay. The first thing I tried was just to formulate the t operator in a very crude approximation as 1 minus tau h, which is just the first order Taylor expansion. But that does not seem to work very well. It really converges for a very long time. So I stick to tools which I knew that time already. And that was formulation of the propagator in terms of Chebyshev polynomials. So this function can be approximated by the following series. Which contains Chebyshev polynomials and which contains modified Bessel functions. So these coefficients are now Bessel functions. Now, expansion itself has very nice properties. First of all, it has very optimal sampling of the eigenspace of the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian is renormalized here to fit the definition range from minus 1 to 1, definition range of the Chebyshev polynomials. So we have to renormalize the time a little bit. But effectively, it's the same propagator. It approximates it really very accurately. Since it has an optimal sampling, it really allows propagation for a very long time. So we can really use very high value of tau. And in fact, in few steps, in like up to 10 steps, we can reach converged results in situation where this linear propagator 1 minus tau h would need 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, you know, few thousand steps to get comparable results. The other thing is the modified Bessel functions are having these nice properties that they actually go to zero exponentially fast if k is larger than tau prime. So if the argument of the Bessel function is larger than the order, the Bessel functions just decay very fast, so we need effectively just finite expansion. Okay. Another advantage is that this is basically just a matrix manipulation, because the tk plus 1 can be expressed as 2 times h prime times tk minus 1 in a simple recursive formula, which again helps to calculate things faster. And so the whole method actually scales linearly with the size of the basis set. Indeed, the basis set size grows very fast. But it allows us to test some of the other approximations, like, for instance, truncate the basis set, follow in some sense the lead which was already given in the paper by Friedman, Nayak, and Stengel, and to use, let's say, ideas from second-order perturbation theory to simplify the basis set, to shrink it, and to expand the calculations. We were eventually able to calculate the low energy spectrum of the extended Hubbard model, and it consists of high number of states. We used just a very small fragment for the moment. You know, we used very small fragment of the extended Hubbard model, basically just that piece you can see here. And we were able to observe changes in the spectrum that seem to indicate critical region between bubble phase. Oops. And geodesic phase. This would be this end. Well, the control parameter in this case is one of the chemical potentials, so we just tune the energy landscape a little bit. And we get a transition between small loops and large loops, as expected, you know, in the model. we still do not have that last step, you know, to jump onto those Jones-Mensch superprojectors, but we needed the tools to actually do this little numerical experiments to be able to somehow get handle on the system. So we believe that this will help us to, you know, the Hamiltonian itself has fixed parameters, which are fixed due to the d-isotopy. So, and the other parameters are somehow guessed, so I believe we are in the region which is d-isotopic. To provide proof for that is might be a complicated story, but, you know, we believe we can do that at some point. So that would, and also a necessary condition for that would be to expand the system to larger sizes. The first calculations were just toy models, effectively. But this should be possible with this technique.
How big are the systems?
You know, the property of the model allows me to formulate like simple fragment of the crystallographic, you know, like an elementary crystallographic unit of the Kagome lattice, which translates into dollar representation as a pixel, effectively as a picture element of this quantum loop gas. So for the moment, we have done single pixel calculations because that was very easy to do, and in fact, just shows that the method we put together. Is enough and it's consistent and it's actually more accurate than the direct diagonalization. So these are like, some, you know, there's a huge set of benchmark calculations behind that. Effectively, one pixel is 12 lattice sites with two particles in it. So the size of that is 66. That's the size of the basis set, the full basis set. But if you go to four pixels, it's already going to be, you know, over a few millions. So the idea is to go to larger and larger systems. Yes, I started this work and I developed these tools at Berkeley, and I was a postdoc with Birgitta Whaley, and she has an expertise in quantum Monte Carlo, and I know that they are working on quantum Monte Carlo calculations along these lines. As far as I understand it today, it seems that though quantum Monte Carlo is very powerful, and I still have to do lots of work to understand it actually, but it seems to me like it cannot have the same power in terms of giving you the exact wave functions for ground state and low-lying excited states, even if you use all those tricks like loop or warm Monte Carlo techniques. So you know, it's the way to do it. Maybe later, once we understand the system well, we understand the exact properties of that. Then we learn a lot from that and we can make that next step. You can see it as a sort of an envelope with, looks like this Russian matryoshka. If you have the Monte Carlo, which is the biggest system, you can, you know, that's the technique which allows you to actually deal with the largest system, and then inside that you have smaller and smaller systems which are dealt with more and more accurate techniques. Yes?
This fall or winter, I spent some time talking with Adrian Flagler over there and Simon Trepps about this model, particularly adding a perturbation.
Yes.
But the thing that sort of stymied us, the reason we didn't really try, is because we didn't see any way, you know, even if we thought of some good perturbation to put in there, we got some candidates, we didn't see any way numerically that we could determine if we, at the end, had a degenerate ground state. Do you have some idea about this? I mean, to me, this is sort of a big stumbling block if you have, like, 40 lattice sites or something.
So the advantage of a system which is in topological phase, I guess, would be that the ground state is degenerate, yes, but it's finite.
One of the main signatures you'd like to detect numerically.
Exactly.
And this is sort of where we're stuck. We don't have a really good idea how to detect the signature.
Yeah. So there are two signatures. One is, and they are connected together. One is your prediction of the degeneracy of the ground state on the torus, which is k plus 1 squared.
Right.
And k is the level of the theory, and it's actually, you know, the double SU2 Chern-Simon theory at level k. And then there is an excitation gap. There is one more thing we may be interested in, and that's actually density of states on the first excited, you know, manifold. So because of accuracy of all those operations, if we do really perform quantum computation. But that may be a little more distant future. So these are really the indicators I was looking at to see that the ground state is finitely, the ground state of the system is finitely degenerate.
But how would you know if it was degenerate or k plus 1 squared degeneracy?
Yeah, so I, for a small system like we have studied so far, I would not even expect it to be degenerate. Uh-huh. I would expect to be split it somehow, you know.
Right.
It's all wrapped around torus, so I guess there's a relation, you know, the diameter of the torus. So if it would be degenerate, how would it manifest itself? It would manifest itself by converging to a different ground state once the ground state is taken out. So I was talking only about the ground state, but of course you can calculate low-lying excited state as well. Just starting with the initial state, where the first we apply a projector and project the ground state out of the initial sample. So it's not anymore there, it can't converge to it. Now, this actually works very well, needs little fine-tuning, because since it allows to propagate for a really long time, it really amplifies the ground state tremendously. So we have to be a little bit careful, maybe doing a shorter time and filtering each step, as I try to suggest here. Okay, but in principle, one can do it. And if we end up in a different, if we end up in the same eigenvalue with a different ground state, and we can see the ground state, then we know it's degenerate. You know, we can check the orthogonality. Now we can, in the same way, we can approach it differently. We can start with a number of samples and then converge to different final states and use like Gram-Schmidt orthogonalization to get a full degenerate manifold of states.
How about a high temperature extension? Just calculate the temperature and try to go to low temperature and see if you have some residual entropy. I don't know if it's easy to do high temperature extension for this type of model.
That's the question.
I don't see the difference between doing your time evolution and doing Langevin's.
Yeah, fine. I mean, that's an option, definitely. And now, what's the difference? So far, I have looked at the Langevin's method. And it seemed to me like whatever libraries I could use, you know, I just found that there are limitations like 100,000. The size of the matrix. Maybe it's not quite true, but I did some little search through available libraries for Langevin's. I did not feel like I would like to reprogram it on my own, because that would be definitely less efficient than what I have here. But this seemed to me like a good approach, whether you can use Langevin's or other techniques, you know, to compare the results. Now, Langevin's itself is probably not as accurate as this propagation technique, because you can get actually by, you know, finite time propagation, you can get accuracy to the minus 16 or whatever higher you can access in computer. It really gives you numerically exact result. So it's interesting by itself as a benchmark, even for, I said it's more accurate than direct diagonalization. It's obviously more precise than Langevin's, but you know, they might be comparable. Also, the scaling might be different, because in this case, you have to propagate a few times to get really the full set of ground states. So it's not that advantage for critical point, but it's definitely advantage for topological phase, where it's defined, you know, to be k plus 1 squared for the torus.
Okay, so probably we should continue this discussion.
Yeah, well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.